Hello, folks. Welcome to the premium podcast series from the Labor Relations Information System. This is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host today as we talk about all things physical agility tests. Are they legal? They exist in virtually every public safety agency, at least as a condition of employment when you are hired. In some places, they exist as an ongoing job requirement. Why is it that there are a bunch of lawsuits around the country very routinely challenging the legality of physical agility tests? And what are the legal theories that are going to be used in those types of cases? I have two guests today. Both of them are shareholders in the Ogletree Deacons Law Firm. Ogletree is one of the largest firms in the country that represents management interests in labor and employment issues. Ogletree has offices all over the country. We have an Ogletree office here in Portland, Oregon. They're in Seattle. They're just all over the place. They have almost 900 attorneys. And a fascinating tidbit about the firm, once a year, they actually get all those lawyers together in a room. They have a firm-wide meeting where training and other stuff goes on. It seems to me to be a complete logistical nightmare, but somehow Ogletree manages to do that. The first of our guests is Ray Gross. Ray is a shareholder in the Detroit Ogletree office. She's been a litigator for over 25 years. She's handled cases at the federal and state level. She's handled a number of EEOC cases and cases under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, and she'll tell you how that applies to physical agility tests. Ray is a graduate of the University of Miami, or she received her bachelor's degree, magna cum laude, and American University's Washington College of Law is where she received her Doctor of Jurisprudence degree. Sarah Keno is also a principal or shareholder in Ogletree. She works out of Ogletree's Tampa and St. Louis offices. I neglected to ask her how she manages both Florida and Missouri. Interesting. A lot of, I think, frequent flyer miles are involved there. Sarah has also been a litigator and provides a wide variety of counseling services to employers. She handles cases in the full range of alphabet soup of federal statutes, the FLSA, the FMLA, the ADEA, the ADA, GINA, and the like. She also gets involved in workplace harassment investigations. Sarah's educational background involves receiving a bachelor's degree from Southern Illinois University in political science, summa cum laude, and she received her Doctor of Jurisprudence from Washington University School of Law. With that introduction, let's talk physical agility tests with Ray and Sarah.
Ray and Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Sure. I got turned on to what you guys were doing by reading an excellent blog post under your names about physical agility tests. And physical agility tests are an issue that I think is very confused in public safety agencies as to what's legal and not legal. Before we get into talking about the tests and what the case law can tell us on this, I'd hope you could tell us a little bit about Ogletree's blog posts. I've, for many years now, have found those blog posts to be very helpful on a wide variety of topics. Why is Ogletree doing this, and what sort of feedback are you getting?
Thank you for asking. Ogletree is a national and now international labor and employment firm, and we have approximately 900 attorneys who strive to stay on top of legal developments, and we are at the cutting edge of technology, or we like to think we are. So we regularly post blogs, we have our own podcast, and we offer webinars and all types of client service-facing developments to keep our clients abreast. So if any of your listeners have any questions about employment law, there's probably something on our blog or we have a podcast on that topic.
Now, our listeners are slightly more on the union side than the employer side, although we have a whole bunch of listeners on both sides. And I like to direct people to Ogletree's webpage. And also there's blog posts that come out from a wide variety of employer law firms. And the message that I give out is, look, this information is good, it's timely, and it's accurate. And best of all, it's free. It doesn't cost anything to sign up for the blog. I hope I'm not giving away a secret here.
Absolutely not. It's easy to subscribe.
Okay. Now, so let's get into physical agility tests and very broadly, the topic that your post was about, and that would be physical agility tests in the context of employment discrimination. And let's start way up at the 10,000-foot level. Why is it that physical agility tests can raise issues under federal law? What sorts of problems can an employer get into?
Yeah, and I think starting at the 10,000-foot level, to go back, when we think about Title VII and federal law, we usually think of intentional discrimination, meaning that an employer volitionally makes a decision based on a protected characteristic, such as race or gender. But Title VII also protects disparate impact claims. So you have the disparate treatment, which is intentional, and disparate impact, which relates to affects a protected group in a high ratio, which we'll get into the 80% or the rule of thumb shortly. But basically, a disparate impact occurs when an employment measure, such as a physical ability or agility test, disproportionately affects one group to their detriment. So PATH, what we often refer to as shorthand for physical agility tests, because of their physical demands, it can result in, for example, say more women or people over the age of 40 failing the test, which can lead to legal challenges.
Now, let's hone in a little bit on the difference between disparate impact and disparate treatment. With disparate treatment, you need to establish, if you're a plaintiff in a case, you need to establish an improper motive, that someone is, the employer is motivated by someone's presence in a protected class. With disparate treatment, you can have an employer that is doing something for the best of reasons, and yet it can still be liable. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. So, the way we see PATs challenged typically are in the disparate treatment area. Disparate impact discrimination requires proof of intent. So that's what people think of as your traditional discrimination claim. That requires showing that somebody either made some intentionally discriminatory comments or that, you know, somebody was some groups are treated more favorably than others. Those kind of claims don't happen in the testing world very much. I mean, the best example of a disparate treatment claim in the testing world would be if you only administered the test to females and not males. In the testing world, what we see more is disparate impact claims. Those are claims that don't require proof of intent. That's a claim that's based on what is, you know, seemingly a neutral process, a test that's given the same way to everybody, but has the impact of screening out at a disproportionately high rate a certain group of people. So, you know, if you give the test to all the males and all the females, but a higher percentage than would be expected by chance of the females fail the test, that's when the test is deemed to have disparate impact.
Yeah, I think that's a great opportunity to segue into the 80% rule. What is a disparate impact? How do courts measure when a difference in results that breaks down along protected class lines, when it is sufficient to trigger disparate impact analysis?
Sure. So the EEOC, as well as other enforcement agencies and courts, have adopted the 4/5 or 80% rule, which we've mentioned a couple of times already. The rule is a non-statistical comparison of selection ratios of protected and non-protected groups of applicants. It's used to determine whether the selection rate for any group is substantially less, and substantially less in this context is less than 80%, than the selection rate for the highest group. In the case of a physical agility test, where the pass rate for one group is less than 80% of the pass rate for their most successful group, a presumption of an adverse impact generally arises. So if women pass, for example, less than 80% of the time that men pass the same test, we have a presumption of a disparate impact.
Does that get the employees over the hurdle of meeting their initial burden of proof in these cases?
No, Ray, I think that is your question. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. So, well, yes, that's true. I mean, simply because, you know, there is an 80% rule violation doesn't necessarily mean that an employer has violated the law. But it does, as you suggested, get the plaintiff or plaintiff's group of plaintiffs over the hurdle in terms of their initial showing. Once there's a showing that there's a violation of or evidence of disparate impact, the burden then falls on the employer to demonstrate that its use of the test is what we call job-related and consistent with business necessity. Now that, and I think we're going to talk a little bit more detail, but that typically requires a pretty comprehensive validation of the test. So it begins with a job analysis and, you know, ends with either a content or a criterion validation to show that the test is actually predictive of how well a person will do on the job.
And we will get to that in a moment. Before we do, I want to go back to the statistics for a moment. Do you ever see other types of statistical analysis showing up in the assessment of these PATHS physical agility tests? For example, do you see use of standard deviations as a substitute for the 80% rule?
Yes, you sometimes see that typically by the, you know, by the defendant or the employer because those kinds of statistical analysis tend to be more precise than the 80% rule. I mean, as Sarah said, the 80% rule is really a comparison factor. It's not a true statistical test. But I would also caution that many federal court judges will adopt the 80% rule as sort of their preliminary examination in terms of whether or not the plaintiff's group has made their threshold case, simply because it is so widely accepted and because it is the rule that is most often suggested as being appropriate by the EEOC.
And Sarah, let me follow up with you on something you said a little bit earlier. Physical fitness tests have the potential of having a disparate impact on protected classes. We've talked about Title VII of the Civil Rights Act a little bit, which protects against discrimination on the basis of, you've mentioned sex as one of the protected classes under Title VII. I seem to remember some old Title VII physical fitness tests that actually showed a disparate impact on the basis of race. Is that possible as well?
I suppose that it is possible. I think the more recent analysis and the more recent focus are on tests that have a disparate impact on age and gender. But if there was a test developed in a certain way, it's certainly not precluded that it would have a disparate impact based on race. We do see that in the context of other types of pre-employment testing, and Ray might want to weigh in on those, but it's outside of physical tests. It's more in the cognitive or mental ability tests.
I see. And we talked a little bit about age discrimination. You just mentioned it, Sarah. When we're talking age discrimination, we're talking about a different federal statute than Title VII, correct?
That is correct. The ADEA is separate, but it follows the same analysis, and the EEOC takes the position that age, physical agility tests or physical ability tests cannot discriminate against people who are over the age of 40.
And of course, I would assume anytime you're testing for physical agility or physical anything, you have the potential of an adverse impact on the basis of disability status as well, right?
You do, but typically it's a little bit harder to establish adverse impact based on disability, only because there's so much wide variety in terms of what people's disabilities are and how they might impact their ability to take the test. It's easy to calculate based on age or gender because those things are sort of, you know, finite characteristics that someone either has or doesn't have for the most part. Physical ability, certainly you can have an ADA claim for an individual, and you could have an ADA claim for a class of individuals. It's just that we see it a little bit less frequently because it's a little harder to establish on a disparate impact theory.
All right. And the only time I've actually, I'm thinking it through, the only time I've actually seen in my practice an ADA issue come up in a physical agility test context is where the employer was refusing to delay the administration of a physical agility test for an employee who had a condition that had a prognosis of it being potentially resolved. So it wasn't a permanent disability where the individual could never pass the test. I don't think I've actually seen an ADA case anywhere else with physical agility tests.
Well, that would what you've described would be sort of a classic example of a potential ADA kind of situation in a physical agility test. The other might be, you know, depending on what the test was. So for law enforcement, for example, there may be different kinds of tests that require you to perform certain tasks that take both arms. And I have seen instances where somebody, you know, who was missing a limb had some alternative means by which they believed they could effectively perform the task, but, you know, it didn't fit expressly into the criteria that were designed for the test. And in those situations, you do have to sort of undertake the same kind of evaluation with the applicant in terms of having a, you know, an interactive dialogue and determining whether or not the person does in fact have some alternative means of performing the job that would be acceptable.
Well, let's get to the more common cases, which are going to be gender and age. Let's assume you've got a physical fitness test, whatever it is. We'll get into the whatever it is in a while. But let's say you have a physical agility test and you have an adverse impact. And Ray, you mentioned that at that point, the burden of proof swings over to the employer side and the employer has to show that the test is job related and consistent with business necessity. I think of those as really two different concepts that are captured in the same sentence. One is job relatedness and the other is business necessity. Is that a correct way of thinking about these things?
They are both analytically separate but somewhat dependent upon each other. So, you know, the job relatedness is typically demonstrated by you having performed before you started giving the test an appropriate validation of the test. And validation almost always begins with a good solid job analysis as the fundamental building block of any validation. And that means that a professional has come in and, you know, examined the jobs in question and determined what the key requirements, physical requirements of those jobs are, the frequency, the duration, and all sorts of factors that go into determining what the sort of bottom line essential elements, physical elements of the job are. The business necessity point also comes into play in terms of your obligations under the Uniform Guidelines for Employee Selection. So those are the EEOC's kind of rules for how you validate a test. The Uniform Guidelines suggest that in addition to doing your basic validation work, it's incumbent upon you to take a look at whether or not there's some other way to appropriately predict whether somebody can do the job that would have a less adverse impact. So you've got sort of a two-stage process. You have to demonstrate that your test does truly test what's required for the job, and passing your test does mean that a person is more likely to be able to do the job, but also that you've taken the time to evaluate whether or not there's some, you know, alternative test or some alternative measure that would have less adverse impact on women or older people that would be equally effective. And if there's not, then you're fine.
Now, let's take the first of those, the job relatedness. And Ray, you just mentioned a word that sounds very simple, but actually is fairly complicated in the context of physical agility tests. And the word was validation. What does that mean to the EEOC and to lawyers who handle these sorts of cases?
Well, you're right. Well, it is very complicated. It can mean a couple of different things, but the basic framework that you would turn to if you were trying to appropriately validate a job in a legally defensible way would be those uniform guidelines on employee selection that the EEOC provides. And for physical abilities tests, there's basically two kinds of ways that you would validate it. One is called content validation, and the other is called criterion validation. Content validation is pretty much what it sounds like. It's establishing through a series of, you know, professionally done job analysis and comparisons that the content of your test is substantially similar to the content of the key physical requirements of the job. So in simplistic terms, if you're hiring people to be, you know, baggage handlers and they have to lift 50-pound pieces of luggage or cartons, you know, all day long, and you give them a test that requires them to demonstrate their ability to lift 50 pounds on a somewhat consecutive basis over a short period of time, that's pretty much content validation. You've demonstrated that the content of the test is substantially similar to the content of the job. By comparison, if you're giving people a test that is more testing their innate physical strength, so if you're hooking them up to a, you know, an isokinetic sort of machine, kind of like gym equipment that's going to measure what their upper body strength is, and from that calculate whether or not they can do your job, that kind of test has to be criterion validated. You have to show that people who can pass that test ultimately, based on their performance on the job, do a better job in actually performing the task.
And Ray, just continuing along that theme, if you were, say, a fire department or a law enforcement agency, and you wanted to go through the process of validating your physical fitness test, and in particular, you wanted to use content validation for your test, what would be the process that you would go through? Who would you try to hire or contract with who could help you out with what sounds to be a fairly potentially complicated system?
Well, there are a lot of vendors out there that will provide these services. This is, I would say, as in most things in life, very much a you get what you pay for sort of experience, though. So you need to be careful about, you know, buying sort of off-the-shelf things that are touted as being validated but are being sold to you by people that don't really have any knowledge or experience of what your particular jobs are. If you want to do it the right way, you're going to hire a professional who will come in and will send in personnel, typically people that have an ergonomic kind of background, sometimes safety as well, will come in and they will actually identify a subset of your incumbent employees who do the job it is that you want to test for. And they'll observe those people, they'll monitor them, they'll look at any kind of written instructions, protocols, safety rules that they have to follow. They'll measure, you know, literally the weights and distances that they have to walk or carry things. They'll talk to the individuals themselves and, you know, kind of run through with them what they believe the key requirements of their job are. And then they'll take all of that information and serve it back up to you in the forms of, you know, here's what we believe the key requirements of the job are, here's what the proposed test is. And then they'll go back and administer the test to the incumbents and see if it does, in fact, according to the incumbents, adequately and satisfactorily mimic what gets done on the job.
So they actually get feedback from the incumbents in the job. The existing firefighters or police officers will say, yes, no, this is our reaction to the test. And then I would assume they might modify the tests according to that feedback.
Typically, yes. I mean, if it's somebody who is following the process the way it's supposed to be done, they will adjust according to the feedback. They will also, you know, make sure that they kind of evaluate for outliers. So if, you know, if 20 of the incumbents all say yes and one says no, they'll go through a, you know, an analysis whereby they'll deem that to be an outlier response, that sort of thing.
All right. And is the process very much the same for criterion validation?
The beginning stages of the process are the same. Criterion validation, unlike content, requires you to ultimately show that there's a relationship between the results on the test and performance on the job. So you ultimately have to either administer the test to an incumbent population and then measure whether or not the people who score better on the test are actually shown to do better on the job. Sometimes the measurement of job success is evaluated in terms of injury rates. So a lot of employers will implement a test thinking it's going to reduce their injury rates. You know, that certainly is possible to do, but it's a little bit harder to defend sometimes. Typically what the government at least will be looking for if they're coming after you on a test is some showing that if you score better on the test, that it's demonstrated based on your, you know, whatever kind of job criteria you can pull, either performance ratings or attendance or injury rates or some combination of all of those three things, that people who score high on the test do better in the job.
And Sarah, let me turn to you for just a moment. The underlying problem here, which we haven't talked about at all, is that unless you are using age and gender graded standards, which we'll come back to because there's been a few cases on that, but unless you're using age and gender graded standards, these tests in the public safety world are going to have an adverse impact both on the basis of gender and age. And I'm in one of those protected classes. I suspect you guys are in the at least one of the others, right?
I'll fess up to two.
That's just, okay. Welcome to the club. And so this is a real possibility that you'll end up with a finding of an adverse impact, which means that you're going to have to go through the process of showing that you've got a job-related test. What's your reaction to that, Sarah?
I think that's exactly right in the sense of we need to go back to job-related and consistent with business necessity. And what are the ties to it? And so to establish that it's job-related, are we using the content validation or the criterion validation? And how did we come up with these measures? Is it a job task simulation, or are we doing the isokinetic test and making some extrapolation? And I think oftentimes when we advise on these situations, we just want to make sure that we're doing it thoughtfully and not making a test harder than it needs to be. And that if it is, and that we're monitoring for disparate impact, and if something is occurring, that we're doing affirmative and thinking proactive, taking affirmative measures and being proactive in trying to minimize any risk and making sure that we continue to monitor it as we continue to do the test, because maybe the job is going to change or will change in the future. And if that happens and we can modify the test, then we certainly want to do so.
And Sarah, we'll post the uniform guidelines on our website along with this podcast so people can see them. You've raised a point that the guidelines make that I think is really important. Simply because you've established a physical fitness test once upon a time doesn't mean you need to stop monitoring what's going on and potentially adjusting the test, right?
That's exactly right, especially as technology continues to develop and we are able to outsource or make things more and more efficient. We want to make sure that our test doesn't get outdated. And whether that's a yearly or quarterly or, you know, every few year checkup, it really depends on the nature of the industry and how quickly the job is changing. But we don't want to let our analysis and our test get stale.
And I can remember once upon a time when we used to call them body fat tests. I think they're now called body composition tests. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with them. It either might involve pinching a portion of whoever the employee's abdomen is, or you might actually put them in a bit of a dunk tank to measure their body composition. Those were once thought of as being the latest, greatest ways to test physical fitness. You almost never see them now. And I think that's because of this monitoring that's going on.
Yeah, and Ray and I briefly discussed those tests. It's not something that we see regularly, as you mentioned, and it would, I think, just be hard to show how that might be job-related and consistent with business necessity. But as a non sequitur, my husband is in the military, and he had to take those tests once upon a time. He hasn't recently, but I suspect that the military might still use them.
Yes, I actually think they do. And it gives rise to a whole body of cases where you have people who have a body fat percentage, that's actually what they're testing for, that is above whatever the threshold is, who are some of the most incredible physical human beings, physically fit human beings you would ever see. And that posed a real dilemma for employers in these situations. Well, let's now get into the actual types of physical agility tests we see in public safety. And I've seen what I think of as five broad categories of these tests. We've already talked about one in a way, and that's job task simulation tests. We see these used in many fire departments around the country where you see firefighters who are climbing a ladder and dragging a dead weight and things like that. And we see them used less in law enforcement. Law enforcement tends to use other types of tests. My general view of these is, assuming the employer has done its homework, you rarely see challenges to job simulation tests, or at least you don't see them with the frequency that you see challenges to other types of tests. Do you have the same assessment?
Generally, I think that's true. I think it's probably because, at least from a purely, kind of objective observer standpoint, they tend to look like they have basic, what we call face validity. I mean, if a firefighter has to, carry a body up a ladder, then asking him to do that as part of a test to get the job seems inherently sort of appropriate. Where they do get challenged sometimes is if you over-toggle. So, if you create a task simulation test that includes tasks that are rarely, if ever, done, or, can be shared tasks that don't necessarily have to be done by one person or another, that's where you can get in trouble a little bit, because it's usually, usually those are gender-based sort of actions where, women applicants are going to contend that you made the test harder than it had to be, even though it was simulating the job, that your weights were too high or your required times or speeds were more than they actually have to be on the job.
My favorite case here with respect to these sorts of job task simulation tests, actually, and it wasn't, they did a little bit of the job simulation, but they did a bunch of other non-aerobic tests like push-ups and sit-ups, is a case, and we'll post the decision on our website as well, involving the city of Erie. And the description that I've given of it in my seminars, and I confess it is a slightly inaccurate description, and I use the inaccuracy to make a point, was that what the city of Erie, Pennsylvania did with its police department once when it was trying to come up with a physical fitness test is it sat three guys down in a room, three police officers down in the room, at least one of whom was a SWAT officer, and they said, okay, now let's come up with a physical fitness test. And one of them said, how about push-ups? And another one said, yeah, let's use push-ups. How many? And the third one said, let's use 17 in a minute. And that's the way they came up with the physical fitness test. And that resulted in a consent decree against the city of Erie. And the reason I use that inaccuracy is to make the point to the people who are in attendance at these seminars that if you're going to use any sorts of tests, and we're now talking in the context of job task simulation tests, it's got to be what people actually do on the job. It's got to be relevant to it. And it can't be something that only Supergirl or Superman can do on the job. Sounds like you're in accord on that, right?
Yes, absolutely. The test that you described, it doesn't surprise me that they resulted in a consent decree because, I mean, two reasons. It's not even remotely following the sort of rigor that's required both by the uniform guidelines and even just by general basic, sort of testing protocol in the industry. But it's also it's not a content-related test. The fact that you can do 20 push-ups may or may not mean that you have the appropriate agility to do the job. So there's no direct correlation without a whole lot of science between whether or not somebody can do 20 push-ups and whether or not they can do the full panoply of physical requirements for a firefighter's job.
Yeah, and you'd have to go the criterion validation route, and that would be really difficult to establish.
Yes.
Now, The second broad type of tests are falling a little bit out of favor. Not a little bit. They're actually falling out of favor. But I am actually shocked at how many, in particular police departments, still use them. And these are age and gender graded aerobic fitness tests. And just a little bit of history, then I'm going to bat it over to you, Sarah, to give you a warning that the question's coming to you. These tests started getting, I think, a great deal of play in the public safety world with the publication of a book called The Aerobics Way by I forget what kind of doctor he was, down in Texas. His name was Ken Cooper, and he ended up creating this series of matrices that measured physical fitness. And so you'd have one matrix that was for a male, another that was for a female, and then each of them would be broken down in 10-year time frames. So, and there were four possible aerobic tests that you would do. The usual one was people would run a mile and a half, but then there would be the aerobic equivalents for cycling and walking and swimming. And as you got older, as you moved from one bracket to the other, your passing score went up. It didn't become more difficult to pass the test. It became easier to pass the test. And when you get to my age bracket, I think you can run a mile and a half in 18 minutes and you would pass, where if you were in your 20s, you'd have to run a mile and a half in about 12 minutes or 13 minutes. And the standards for females was lesser than the standards for males. Now, how do courts look at those sorts of tests? How are they faring out there in the real world of litigation?
I would say these are the types of tests that we don't see much of anymore in terms of having a sliding scale, because again, the analysis goes back to, is it job related and consistent with business necessity? And if you're having different standards for different people, you should really be testing to the lowest common denominator for everyone, because that's what you need to actually perform the job. And if you don't need to run a mile in 15 minutes, we shouldn't be making certain groups do that. And still, the bigger picture is this having a disparate impact? And that's what we focus on. And if the test isn't actually having a disparate impact because of the sliding scale, then it could be a non-issue. It's just big picture, what are the goals and why are we implementing this test? And have we actually connected it to performance on the job?
Yeah, so to add Will to what Sarah said, it's not, I mean, gender norming is somewhat still unsettled. The area of the law, as I think, you know, some of the case law would suggest, it's typically used by, I mean, federal government has used it in the past, but it's counterintuitive to the idea of validating a basic physical abilities test. I mean, if you are trying to demonstrate that being able to, you know, run a certain distance in a certain period of time is the minimum basic requirement for the job, it doesn't make any sense that you would allow, you know, you would require, you know, men to run this 1.5 mile run in 12 minutes, but women in 14 minutes and older people in 17 minutes. The only argument for doing it is if for some reason actual performance of the job also has what we would call sort of bona fide occupational qualifications. So if you, you know, are running a particular, like in the military, for example, there are certain, in some cases, tasks that females just don't perform. I mean, if you're in that sort of a situation and you have a bona fide reason why certain tasks are only performed by certain people, you might be able to norm the results. But otherwise, it's a little bit, at least in our world, it's a little bit counterintuitive to the whole idea behind test validation.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to be an employer having to defend against a business necessity argument. I wouldn't want to be an employer that had one standard for one group of people where if they passed it, they could be a police officer or a firefighter, and yet I would have a higher standard for any other group of people, particularly if those groups are different based upon their age or their gender. That's like starting in last place in a 100-yard dash. You're in for a world of trouble
Yeah, I would agree that I think that, you know, the historical rationale or thought process behind it was that, you know, if you have a historically all male police force and you are trying to, you know, diversify the representation of female officers in your force, that somehow gender norming is a way to sort of, you know, even the playing field and give them a leg up. And as well intentioned as it may be, it's just a little bit counterintuitive to how you demonstrate that the test itself is really testing what's required for the job.
And of course, Sarah, I'm going to go back to you on this. There, you mentioned it earlier. There's also the question about whether a mile and a half run is job related for either a police officer or a firefighter. I mean, I've represented police and fire my whole career, and I can tell you with a great deal of assurance that virtually no police officer or firefighter runs a mile and a half or anything close to it on the job. Would not something that would involve a long aerobics test like that, would not that pose some job relatedness issues?
I think it would, especially, as you say, because they're not doing it on a regular basis. And if there were some way to validate that their aerobic fitness correlates to the rest of their performance on the job, say, you know, sprinting after a suspect or carrying a fire hose, if you can establish that through a good validation study, maybe we get there. But on its face, I agree with you that it seems problematic because as a police officer or a firefighter, you're probably not running a mile and a half on a regular basis, and it doesn't seem to have an apparent or easy intuitive connection to the ability to do the job.
Now, some public safety agencies, in fact, the Cooper Institute itself, have moved away from these age-graded and gender-graded aerobics tests, but they continue to use aerobic tests, but they'll use a single standard rather than one that is normed for either age or gender. That would raise, I would think, the disparate impact problem again, right?
Yeah,
it could. Go ahead, Ray.
In that case, you have the combination of, you know, you are now probably appropriately not gender or age norming, but you are applying a test that is much harder to demonstrate the business necessity and job relatedness of if it's truly just an aerobics test, because what you're lacking is the sort of, you know, science behind connecting how many push-ups or pull-ups you can do or how far you can run or how fast you can run between that and the job requirement.
And then we have another set of agencies that use either in whole or in part non-aerobics tests. And the standards here that you see all the time are push-ups and sit-ups and maybe some sort of weight resistance work, whatever it might be. Once again, you're going to see a disparate impact there, I would assume, and you have to be very cautious about using those tests. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. So we're going to run into the same concerns that we see in the aerobic context. If we cannot establish the job-related and consistent with business necessity rationale, the tests are going to face the same challenges.
There's a physical fitness plan, if you can call it that, that's gotten an awful lot of play in the news in the last 3-4 weeks that it's been out. And this is one from the Texas Department of Public Safety. And what the plan is, or the requirement is that all of the troopers who work for the Department of Public Safety are going to have to meet a waistline measure. You can't have a waistline that is more than 40 inches if you are a woman, or 35 inches for a man. And if you don't pass that waistline measure, you potentially could be subject to termination. Once upon a time, I saw waistline measures of physical fitness, but honestly, I haven't seen it in decades. I was completely shocked when I saw this. I was astounded that there were different standards for women than men. I want to know why it is women can have 40-inch waistlines and men can only have 35-inch waistlines. I'm kind of curious as to where they came up with those numbers from. But mostly when I read these stories, I thought I could feel out there in ether somewhere a collective shudder among defense side employment lawyers like the two of you, thinking, oh my goodness, what are they doing? I am assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, and Ray, I think I'll bat this one to you. I am assuming that a standard like that to the, I mean, first of all, it has a, it's actual disparate treatment where you're treating men and women differently, that a standard like that would have to meet all of the testing requirements that we have been talking about for the last half hour.
For the most part, yes. I mean, if you look at the uniform guidelines, they technically apply to, you know, test and other selection procedures, which are used as the basis for any employment decision. So selection procedure is an all-encompassing definition that includes all kinds of things, and certainly it could include a waistline measurement. I've read the press too, I know that there's a claim that there's some sort of science behind the waistline measurement and your physical fitness for doing the job, but I'm not privy to what that might be. It seems to me like it might be hard to establish, but, you know, certainly I think that, you know, as you suggested, they may be in for a fight in terms of defending that particular requirement, both the fact that it's different for men and women and whether or not it's job related at all, frankly.
Yeah, I see there's already been one lawsuit filed over that, so we'll stay tuned. If Texas is going to stick with that, that'll make its way through the court systems. We're pretty guaranteed. Now, one last question for you. Sometimes, you almost always in a public safety agency see a physical agility test as a standard for hire. You don't too often see physical agility tests as a standard for continuing employment. So you have to pass it once to get the job, and then you don't ever have to pass it again. That's probably the case in, I don't know, if I had to do a broad rule of thumb, 2/3 of public safety agencies. But in the others, you do see some continuing conditions of employment of passing these sorts of tests. And then there's another set of agencies where it's not a condition of employment, but instead it is an incentive plan. And I confess to having bargained several of these on behalf of my clients, where if you pass the test, you get more money, 5%, 10%, whatever it might be. Is the fact that you're only using the test for an incentive plan any sort of hedge against any liability under Title VII or the ADEA?
I would
no.
say no.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
You
I think we're
you
right?
both said.
So, Ray, why don't you?
You both leapt
mine?
To know.
Sorry, Will. Yeah, I mean, Title VII is pretty clear that you can't discriminate in the terms and conditions of employment, and an incentive plan to gain extra money is a term and condition of employment. And Ray, I'll let you elaborate on what you were thinking as well.
No, that was pretty much it. I mean, it's not, you know, the prohibition is on discriminating in any kind of condition of employment, so bonuses would be included. And it also would, you know, I mean, maybe there's a basis for it, but if everyone is performing the minimum requirements of the job, the fact that you are more physically fit in your performance of that requirement doesn't intuitively entitle you to a greater bonus, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, and the way I've always sort of analogized this when the issue has come up is to say, can you pay somebody more because they're a woman or a man? Or because they're Hispanic or Asian or Caucasian or African American? Well, if you can't do that, you can't pay them more if they pass a physical fitness incentive plan that has an adverse impact on any of those conditions.
And I don't, and I would, just, you've negotiated them, so maybe you have more insight into this than we do, but I would tend to imagine that the thought process behind that is that you know, if you incentivize people to become more physically fit, then it is likely to reduce your overall, you know, injury, workers' comp, absenteeism rate because you have a more physically fit workforce. And, you know, again, may, as well-intentioned as that might be, working through the defensibility of a test that may have a disparate impact puts you right back in the same situation that we've been talking about, you know, all through today's discussion, which is that you've got to demonstrate job-relatedness and business necessity.
And I completely agree with you that that's the motivation and sort of the added motivation that someone who is physically fit is you're going to have less health insurance claims and they'll be generally more capable of doing their job. The problem is I've never seen that quantified. And then you run into the job relatedness and business necessity problems. Well, I want to take this moment to thank both of you, Sarah and Ray, for your time in speaking with me about this issue. I hope we've unraveled some of the mysteries of the legal implications of physical agility tests. And I want to thank you again for being very generous in the run-up to this podcast and speaking with me. And I much appreciate it. And folks, that's it for another premium edition of the Labor Relations Information Systems podcast series. We hope to have you join us when we once again talk about an issue that's of importance in the public safety labor world. This is Will Aitchison signing off.